Thank you very much indeed. I was very amused that Professor Casey's found himself hailed as an ally by feminists on the trans issue, and has indeed been described, and I think he's boasting about this here, as a TERF. And as we all know, that TERFs are trans-exclusionary radical feminists. So me and Professor Casey, I think, can self-describe as tenants, trans-exclusionary non-feminists. His speech resonated on all sorts of levels with me. When he talked about the willingness, the extraordinary capacity of people who identify as woke, a term which actually I try my best to avoid. I called to mind my own daughter, who's 16 at the moment, but when the Black Lives Matter protests were going strong in London and everybody was turning up for demonstrations at every turn, my daughter, who was, I think, 13 at the time, didn't just go for the Black Lives Matter protests, she went for the Black Trans Lives Matter protests. And her placard was, "It's not enough not to be racist, you have to be anti-racist," except she couldn't spell racist, and so that particular placard had to be left at home. When I was asked by David to come, I called to mind the abortion referendum, where Maria did absolutely heroic work, was swimming like a salmon against the current. Obviously, everybody was seen off and it failed, but it was a noble and heroic attempt actually to speak the truth against the prevailing culture and climate. And that requires a degree of courage as well as articulacy, for which I think we must all thank her. But at the end of that campaign, there was that gathering outside Dublin Castle. And the Irish Times' Miriam Lord, who's their parliamentary sketchwriter and a very good sketchwriter, was there. And she was in full triumphalist mode. And at the end of the sketch, she had that telling little phrase saying, "Thanks all the same, we'll take it from here." That is to say that the future social and cultural agenda of Ireland was going to be taken out of the hands of the clerics and conservatives and the male establishment, and was going to be taken into other hands. We'll take it from here. And as a journalist, one naturally admired the phrase because it was memorable, and every journalist should use the first person, plural or singular, in order to create a fake sense of identity with your readership. And that's what she was doing. But the question raises itself, which is, who's we here? Because the notion she was positing was that it was going from the hands of people who are unaccountable to the hands of us, people who were accountable, and or people who were us. I mean, it's we that she was talking about. But the question that has to be raised was, who is the we? And power has indeed been transferred from the church, from the formerly conservative institutions and establishments, as Professor Casey has described, and they have gone elsewhere. And the question is, where have they gone? Now, David Quinn has done remarkable work, almost single-handedly, on this front, which is to identify where power in Ireland has actually been directed, having formerly resided with institutions such as the church, and it has gone to other parties. And what is very clear from what David describes continuously in his pieces and on social media is that it's not necessarily going to the people. There has not been a transfer of power, authority, and agency from those who formerly had it to the rest of to the grassroots, as it were. It has gone to other people. It's gone to NGOs and pressure groups who exert an extraordinary and disproportionate influence over public debate in Ireland, and particularly in RTE, for whom they provide a notionally independent voice, when in fact the agenda that an NGO might have would be very different from that of the population at large. It's certainly gone to the self-appointed commentariat. And being a member of the self-appointed commentariat, I've got some degree of sympathy with this, but it is by no means going to people, to the grassroots, to the mass of the electorate. Pundits and the commentariat are not everybody. We pretend to be, but we're not. And what's actually happening, I think, is that the authority of the commentariat is, if anything, greater now in post-Catholic Ireland than it was at that time. That is to say, there was a book by Derek Scally. I don't know whether you've come across it. It's very good, in fact. He's the Irish Times Berlin correspondent. And he wrote a book called The Best Catholics in the World, which is rather a sad book, which an analysis of the condition of Catholicism in Ireland, and in brief, the answer to what is the condition is that it's demoralized. But he had a very telling little episode in that book where he was talking to somebody about how he saw the state of Ireland, and this poor fellow in Mayo or somewhere, not, no disrespect to Mayo, but anyway, somebody not sort of here in the middle of Dublin, but to this Catholic in the west of Ireland, was talking to him about how he felt about the new state of affairs and how he felt about RTE, and this fellow said at one point, "Who is Fintan O'Toole anyway?" What he was talking about was, in fact, the transfer of authority to a new kind of theocracy, a new locus of authority, which is the journalistic and pundit classes. Now, I'm an admirer of Fintan O'Toole. He's a very good journalist and a compelling columnist, but nobody elected him. They didn't elect me, they didn't elect him. We have no authority other than that we're read, but we have in the culture of the moment a disproportionate amount of influence by virtue of the fact that real influence doesn't reside necessarily with the electorate. It doesn't entirely reside with the electorate, and it has migrated to the groups that Professor Casey identified, who are self-identified as activists, many of them in NGOs, and many of them forming a very small proportion of the institutions that they're part of. Now, the new environment in Ireland is, I'd say, more illiberal than the old. I don't dispute for a moment that the island in which I grew up, I was born in the 60s, and I grew up kind of in the era when Ireland was still self-consciously and self-confidently Catholic, and there was emphatically a degree of clerical authoritarianism, and it can certainly be seen after the Second Vatican Council when protesting congregations simply were swept aside by indifferent clerics who installed and took away altar rails and installed hideous altars against the wishes of their own congregations. So the problem of clericalism was real. But the problem that we've got at the moment is that we've got authority being wielded by people who aren't actually particularly accountable. And the problem in Ireland has always been of cultural conformity. We do tend to, I don't know whether it was a product of history of having lived for so long under the majority rule from London and from the dominance of Britain in this regard, but on this side, this tendency to coalesce around a particular point of view, whether Catholic in those days or anti-Catholic now, is very real. And added to that, you've got the journalistic problem of mixing with your own tribe. So it's certainly the case anywhere you go that that journalists are going to hang around with other journalists, and there is going to be a degree of groupthink. And it happens in London, it happens still more here, where the actual body of journalists is smaller and the degree of social conformity that much greater. And so you have got that tendency to groupthink amplified. And I think it was terribly apparent during the abortion referendum. I remember there was one RTE presenter who was interviewing Paddy Tobin about kind of what was the situation. Was it a 14-year-old girl getting raped and then finding herself pregnant? And anyway, Paddy Tobin was doing his best to answer the question in a rational and I think a compassionate fashion. And she was looking at him as though he's a plate of sick. Now, a few weeks later, the very same person was interviewing somebody from the groups who wanted to exclude pro-life protesters from the abortion clinic environment. And her demeanor could not have been more different. She was talking to somebody who was her. She was talking to a mirror image of her own point of view. And being human, you naturally respond more sympathetically and more empathetically to somebody who resembles yourself. And I remember her saying to her, "It's going to be a long road ahead, isn't it?" So she was effectively identifying herself with the person that she was meant to be interviewing. She was not meant to have a view on this matter of the abortion exclusion zones, but it was just normal and natural for her to say, this is our struggle. It's going to be a long road ahead for us, isn't it?" And I think that that dissonance, that inability to see yourself positioned within a particular mindset is really perilous, and it's absolutely endemic in Irish journalism. And I think that's all the more reason to salute David Quinn here, because in London, I can think of, without even bothering, I know it's a larger population and all the rest of it, but in British journalism, I can, without even thinking about it, think of a dozen socially conservative journalists who will push back against the direction of travel of the government. And in Ireland, I can think of two. One is David and one is Breda O'Brien. And my apologies to all the countless other people that I've missed. But in terms of the proportion of socially conservative pundits to the numbers on the other side, there isn't even a pretense at symmetry. One has, you have people sort of wheeled on occasionally, like Maria was during the abortion referendum. But that is a sort of self-conscious attempt. Oh, for God's sake, we've got to have somebody from that side. And on they come. But it is a kind of an act which, in effect, reinforces the consensus. And what's been very interesting to see in terms of the abortion debate is that there hasn't been a debate. And Maria has been conspicuous by her absence from the national broadcaster, even though a number of the issues that are now being raised in terms of the enactment of the abortion legislation are becoming very live issues. I mean, the whole thing was sold, I think, on a false premise. I was here for the referendum, and to judge from the literature, every single abortion that was going to happen was going to be one where the fetus couldn't survive or it posed a terminal risk to the life of the mother. In which, if that were the case, then I would be entirely sympathetic, and I would write into the legislation that that abortion could be permitted where the condition of the fetus was incompatible with life. So that could have been addressed. But the nature of the argument was indescribably dishonest. It was very, very partisan. And now, with the new measures that are going to be introduced in terms of doing away with the 3-day waiting period before between one consultation and the abortion going ahead, which has actually resulted in has objectively resulted in hundreds, possibly up to 1,000 fetuses surviving to birth. That was sold as part of the package which people voted for with the referendum, and that very quietly is being done away with in the name of not patronising women and treating abortion as another form of healthcare. And whenever anybody says abortion is another form of healthcare and it should be treated no differently from women's healthcare in any other regard, the only response is that there is no other form of healthcare that has a terminal effect on the life of another individual. That is to say, this particular element of healthcare has fatal consequences for another human being. And it cannot be discussed in any other terms. Now, as I say, the environment here is conformist, and I can only think of that as being the explanation for the hate crime law. In England, in Britain, it would not have got to this point. It would not have got off the starting block. It is a matter of shame that the Irish civil liberties organisations have not only acquiesced in the hate crime legislation, but they have actually advocated it. You have people who are meant, whose raison d'être is the pretence of defence of free speech, who have in fact produced legislation which is utterly inimical to it. I cannot conceive in the UK or the police being given the power to enter somebody's home, get them to open their computer and find out, or they've got something somewhere that somebody else might find hateful. I mean, the hate legislation in Britain is based on that flawed premise that hate is in the eye of the recipient. It's not your intention that matters, it's how it's received. So if I feel that your observations are hateful, it's not enough for you to protest that no, in fact, you have no intention of that kind. It's entirely my perception of it that's at issue. So that is an issue in the UK. But this notion that the police can examine not just really matter in your home, but that of your flatmates or your best friend or your mother, and take exception to that, it is actually terrifying. It could not happen in a proper liberal society, and it should not be happening here. And the fact that it is happening is a sign that liberalism here has become coercive. Now, a whole debate about abortion, and I'm sorry to dwell on this because I know that the issues that we care about go much broader than that. It was quite funny when I was at work a couple of weeks ago because the paper I work for has got a free speech campaign, and it's interviewing all sorts of people like Richard Dawkins, who's having trouble from Islamists. I mean, that's quite funny. And you've got Afua Hirsch, who's again having trouble from Islamists, and people having difficulty with trans activists, and Professor Casey. I find it all quite amusing. But anyway, the content editor, because that's what it's called nowadays, so that you don't discriminate between print and digital, said, "Are there any issues that you want to talk about? I mean, is there anything that you think that we should be addressing in terms of free speech?" And I said, "Yeah." Immigration and abortion. And she said, "No, we don't want that. I don't like that. I don't think so. We're not going there." So I don't want to suggest that the two issues are in any way related or indeed overlapping in any way. But the fact is that the free speech, from the point of view of my colleagues who were actually doing something rather worthy in advancing this free speech campaign, had its limits. And the limits were those things that were felt to be unmentionable. Now, one of the things that has happened after the abortion debate is the closing down of a debate on abortion. That is to say that you are not allowed to say what abortion actually entails. To my way of thinking, there is the church has followed the science. At one point in its history, the Catholic Church believed with Aristotle that the humanity of the fetus happened at a particular point during gestation. It was Aristotelian biology, so it was felt that ensoulment happened roughly around the age of, well, around 28, 40 days, depending on whether you're a boy or a girl. So girls got their souls a bit later than boys. But anyway, the Catholic Church at the time followed Aristotelian science, which was what was the norm at the time. And then later, when it became very clear that the conceptus, the thing which is conceived, had an existence where there was no dividing line in terms of the continuity of development of the fetus, then the church went with that and gave the fetus the benefit of the doubt as to its humanity from conception. And it is that, it is giving the fetus the benefit of the doubt as to its human status. But you can't actually say that in normal discourse anymore. That is to say, it has come to the point where the humanity of the fetus lies in the perception of the mother. That is to say, if the fetus is perceived by the mother as wanted and as desirable, and she's looking forward to the birth, then that endows the fetus with humanity. And if she does not want the child, then it cannot even be discussed in terms of humanity. Now, I can curse myself for not having kept the reference, though I've written about it before. There was one piece by a philosopher in the TLS, Times Literary Supplement, where a philosopher actually said that the fetus is more or less in the eye of the beholder. That is to say, if wanted, it has a particular status as a human being and will be talked about as such. You'll talk about the baby for a fetus of 12 weeks gestation. You're not going to talk about the baby if it's if he or she is not wanted. And there was a particularly distressing case a little while ago in Britain where a neonatal nurse, Lucy Lethbury, actually killed very small babies in her care. And obviously there was general outrage about the whole thing, and how couldn't there be? But what was interesting was that some of the infants in the neonatal ward, by definition, were very early neonates. That is to say that they could have been aborted on grounds of well, actually, under the present abortion law, up to 24 weeks. Some of them were earlier than 24 weeks. So under the law, they could have been aborted, and nobody would have any right to complain about it. But these were very much wanted babies, and so the fact that they were killed by her was a matter for outrage and scandal. But nobody actually thought about the logical implications of this, which is that scientifically, the neonate is what it is. It doesn't depend on the perception of anybody else what its status is, or it shouldn't depend on the perception of anybody else what its status is. It is either human or it's not. And if it is human, it doesn't actually depend on whether the mother wants it to come into being or not. What's happened also in England is that there's been a call for the decriminalisation of abortion, that is to say, to be put on the level of any other kind of healthcare, in the wake of the prosecution of some women for very late abortions. Now, this is after 24 weeks, and I think in one case it was a fetus at 8 months gestation. There is no difference in my mind between doing away with a fetus at that point in its development and infanticide. And yet, because it was seen simply in terms of the condition of the mother, somebody with other children perhaps, somebody who was in a difficulty with her relationship, it was not seen in terms of the standing of the baby. It was seen simply in terms of the problems of the mother. And so all the moral outrage was directed against the law, which had very cruelly prosecuted her for doing away with the child after the 24-week limit without benefit of being disabled, because as you may or may not know, a disabled fetus may be killed any point up to gestation, up to birth, because of its condition. And that doesn't just comprehend life-threatening conditions which make its survival impossible. It also comprehends conditions, obviously Down's is one of them, which we would just think of in terms of handicap. So what I'm trying to say in all this isn't entirely to do with abortion. It's simply to do with what's possible to say in public discourse and what's not possible to say in public discourse, including in journalism. There are some things you can't say because it's an error of taste to say them, and that's just one example of that. Now, the awful thing about the present situation is that as Catholics, one tends to end up being defined by other people. So I was mentioning to one of my colleagues that I wouldn't mind reviewing, it's a film I think called The Nun. Actually, I said that before, I realised it was a horror film, and personally I'm way too squeamish to be able to watch a horror film. I just can't do it. So it would be me under the seat and somebody else telling me what happened. But anyway, I was saying something about the Sisters of Mercy, and he said, "Oh, you've got to see The Woman in the Wall. You've got to see The Woman in the Wall. It's just awful." And so I thought, yeah, fine. And then it dawned on me, actually, I was educated by Sisters of Mercy. I belong to the generation that, from sort of soup to nuts, from kind of senior infants right up to sixth class, and then into secondary school, I was educated by the Sisters of Mercy. Who is this guy? Very nice English person, I imagine, kind of vaguely sort of secular Church of England, telling me what constituted Sisters of Mercy. Who was he to tell me what was my condition as somebody who'd been through the hands of the nuns? Now, The Woman in the Wall, I gather, again, I've got a sort of tolerance for of nonsense, which is actually quite limiting. So I've just relied on other people to tell me about it. But it depicts, I gather, the nuns in this case as just human gargoyles, no compassion, no empathy, no feeling for the women in their charge. And I can assert that this is untrue. It is not the case. that Sisters of Mercy were not like that. There was one nun in my primary school who should not have been let anywhere near children. Absolute monster. And it was very difficult for the children who were in her care. But she was outnumbered about 15 to 1 by women who really did care for us. We were the reason why they got up in the morning. And some were better than others. But they were devoted. I mean, they gave their lives to us. And so my experience of being a product of the Sisters of Mercy was being defined by somebody who had never come across a real life nun in their lives, and whose experience was entirely mediated by The Woman in the Wall, a Netflix documentary, which is a travesty of a real situation. I can actually pull rank a little bit because I don't have any illusions about the modern laundries, because my aunt almost ended up in one, and she became pregnant with my cousin at a time when you didn't do this sort of thing out of outside marriage, and she was about to be sort of forced off in the direction of a modern laundry, and naturally she didn't like it, the prospect at all, and her parents just didn't want any, my grandparents didn't want to have her on the premises. And to cut a long story short, my mother brought her to London to one of those charities that looked after women in trouble, and the charity was completely overwhelmed by all these Irish women coming over who were pregnant. And she said, no, you've got to go back to Ireland. We cannot accommodate you here. We're full. Go back, and there'll be institutions there to look after you. And my mother took one look at her and said, my mother's English, and she said, if you don't take her in, I'm going to send her to the Salvation Army. And they were so horrified at the notion that the baby might end up with leading Protestants that they capitulated instantly. And at the end of the day, that's how my cousin was born in London, but indeed came back to ARCO and flourishing with us now. And I can, from personal experience, assert that it wasn't just a Catholic problem. My father, without trying to get too autobiographical here, my father was conceived by the very respectable daughter of a very respectable Protestant postmaster in Ballycanoo. And he was taken away to the Countess of Bessborough Hospital when he was a day old. And they didn't want him by his aunt. And they didn't want him. So he ended up coming back to Arklow and being handed over a shop counter when he was a day old. The point I'm trying to make here is merely that if you think this is simply a Catholic problem, it jolly well wasn't. No class in Ireland at that point, no denomination actually welcomed an embarrassing bastard child being admitted to the family circle. So we can acknowledge the badness of what happened here, but we also need to take into account that it was a complex picture, and the situation in England for these women was very difficult also. There's a book, if you're interested, called In the Family Way, which describes the situation of a child in the Coram Foundation, which was, I thought, a very benign institution. And it turns out that there was dreadful abuse within that institution as well. So that is, I think, what I meant by saying truth about the past. One can acknowledge that. One has to use the very basic tool of the audit. That is to say, we draw up an account of the situation in Catholic Ireland in terms of what was good and what was bad. That is to say, that there were very real problems, and the problems of clerical sex abuse, which we've had very recently. Holy Ghost Fathers in Blackrock is just the most recent. And that can be set on, obviously, on the debit side, so can the modern laundries. But on the credit side was the fact that there were men and women who were giving their lives to the service of the state, to education, to hospitals, and to the care of the sick. Nuns and brothers ran the Irish education system, and not for profit and not for gain, but because they felt that it was their duty to do so. And many of us have reason to be grateful for them for having done so. And I just wanted to say that when we talk about giving a truthful account of the Ireland in the past, we mustn't allow that truth to be defined by other people. We have got to assert that it was not so, because at the moment one is being given an account of Catholic Ireland as a kind of nightmare from which we've all woken up, and a dark a dark age from which we've progressed into the light. In fact, it was not a dark age. Those of us who were there can assert that there was elements of that there was a very real sense of solidarity, of community, of cohesiveness, and indeed of kindness, which I find absent now, perhaps unfairly. So I think that we must beware of false memory syndrome. We must beware of having our own past defined by other people. And we're going to find that, I think, again and again. What Professor Casey said rings very true in some regards. So in Canada, for instance, it has been asserted as a fact, an incontrovertible fact, that the Catholic institutions not only abused Native American children, they actually killed them. And there was an account of mass graves that were allegedly of these Native Americans. And the fact is that no human remains have been found, that the allegations are false insofar as the empirical evidence has not been found to corroborate it. Nonetheless, questioning this particular narrative that the Catholic Church had been responsible for injury, abuse, and in some cases death of children in its care, guilty of kind of a species of genocide, cannot be questioned because so much was invested in that particular narrative by victim groups, by in terms of compensation, and also in terms of how Canadians like to see themselves. David Quinn, I think, will have a much better idea than I about the situation in regard to the Tuam infants. But I think on Tuam, we shall have to see whether there were hundreds and hundreds of babies' remains actually in a septic tank. I think it unlikely myself, but I'll be prepared to go with the evidence when it appears. Now, these things I think are very important, and they're very important simply in terms of saying what is true. As I've tried to intimate, we don't need to suggest that Catholic Ireland was without its flaws, because patently it did have its cruelties and its excluded groups, and probably wasn't the best place in the world to be homosexual, for instance. But nonetheless, one has to have a complete picture, and one has to refuse to have that picture drawn by other people, because that is what's happening, and it's often been drawn by those with no actual experience of living in the society. And I think that we're going to be faced with other issues of that kind in the very near future. But the other danger here is that Catholics may eventually find themselves, ourselves, being defined in terms of issues. That is to say, Catholicism is about homosexuality. Catholicism is about abortion. Catholicism is about a particular sort of family type. Catholicism is about antagonism to this, that, and the other. It's as though when you say the creed, it's a succession of things that you do not believe in. Whereas when one says the creed, you believe in the forgiveness of sins, the resurrection of the dead, and life everlasting. I mean, the picture is as large, as whole, and as broad as that. And one is in danger, I think, of being again defined by other people. When the BBC was talking about the synod that opened in Rome, it said, as though to make the thing sort of intelligible to people, and it's expected that the issue of gay marriage and gay blessings and the ordination of women will be discussed. Now, I've got my own doubts about the synod. It does seem to me to be a process about a process, or talking about talking. I can see that it's got problems, but what it isn't about is those particular concrete issues. It may be a forum for talking about these issues, but that's not what the object of the exercise is. But again, the church is being defined in term very, very narrowly, simply in terms of these very tiny, very small, not marginal, not unimportant issues, but in terms of issues, not in terms of the full expansive idea of what the faith is about. We assert as Catholics that man is a worshipping animal. That's our primary relationship is to do with God. So it's not simply to do with a whole series of social issues that are intensely divisive. It is about the large question that we were created and loved by God, and that is the source of our human dignity and everybody else's human dignity. Now, the problem with Ireland in the new order, I think, is that we're trying to create something new. I was very interested to see that the Chief Justice, Donal O'Donnell, wants to institute a non-religious service for the start of the law term, because at the beginning of every legal year, you have a church service where lawyers are reminded that they're not gods in their own right, that they serve under God, and so they have particular duties in terms of affecting justice, which for which they will one day be accountable. And in my view, that's something very salutary for overpaid lawyers to hear. But he wants to have something very different. He wants a new secularist service. And you get the same thing happening in England, where at one of the ends of court, they've done away with the Christian grace, and they've decided that they want simply to reflect with gratitude. We don't know gratitude to whom or to what, but they want to reflect with gratitude on the fact that they have their dinner in front of them. And the solution to that, of course, would be to have a Latin grace, and nobody ever takes exception to a Latin grace because the number of people who understand every word is very few, and those who do understand it don't mind. But it is an attempt to reimagine ourselves in as post-Christians, as post-Catholics, and I'm not at all convinced that this is where people want to go. Certainly, most of the people at the Inns of Court that I've spoken to really, A, weren't exercised by it, never had a thought in their mind that this was an issue, and really find the whole thing kind of a non-issue, something that they don't want to be bothered with. And we've been through this before. In the French Revolution, part of the sense that this was a brand new order, this was a breaking with the past. It was kind of the kind of Cambodian year zero, except in 1789, took the form of having a new calendar. So instead of having the months of the year named after kind of January, February, March, April, May, it was done on the basis of the seasons. So the season of mists, or the season of fruitfulness, the season of frosts, and all the rest of it. But it was a real attempt to recreate a new way of thinking by having a new calendar. And what we have got now is, I think, a kind of attempt to secularize everything. That is to say, the seasons are being reimagined. For instance, in a Catholic world, there is a season of fasting. It happens to be Advent actually coming up, and that was prior to about kind of 50 years ago, a time when people gave things up, not went to Christmas parties. And Lent, 40 days, you've got 40 days of abstinence. What you've got now is something that attempts to replace it, but it replaces it worse. It replaces it with something less satisfactory. So instead of Lent and Advent, you've got something now called Sober October. So people give up drink in October, which is actually one of the worst times of the year to be giving anything up. I mean, in civilized countries, you have beer fests in October. You go to Munich and you get absolutely stoches because that's the time when the beer comes on. And then you go to France, similarly, it's Beaujolais Nouveau est arrivé. Well, bring it on. You've got the new harvest, you've got the new wine, and that's when we're going to just get absolutely legless. So the new order here is actually at odds with the season, but it derived from Australia, so that may be why. And we've got the other phenomenon, which is more terrible than anything I can describe, which is Dry January. Now, the first thing about Dry January is that it happens during the 12 days of Christmas. So you're about sort of 7 days into Christmas, and all of a sudden you give things up. You not only stop celebrating, you go into abstinence mode. In the second place, it is happening in January, which is the worst time of the year to be giving up anything, let alone carbs and drink. This is a notion which could only have been posited by people who had no actual relationship with the seasons, no actual relationship with the weather, and certainly no relationship with the Christian calendar. But it is, as I say, an attempt to replace the Christian cycle of the year and of the seasons with something that's countercultural and certainly counter-religious. We get this happening in every single sphere. For instance, there's something called the men's sheds, where men who sometimes find themselves isolated and find it difficult to talk to other men have some sort of woodworking project or something like that. You sort of build a boat or you build a few shelves for the home, and you get a chance to chat with other men, and that helps alleviate the problems of kind of emotional continence, which some men have. In the old days, what you had was a whole line of men opposite the church, many of them actually standing in the porch, another crowd of them standing on the other side of the road like this, looking at people coming out of mass. And they were standing there in absolute silence, but it actually was silence and solidarity with each other. In the days when the entire place went to mass, there was an opportunity for men to hang out with other men, and if they wanted to talk, though being men, a lot of times they didn't. But there was in that communal activity a space for men to be with other men, and then there were things to do, like doing the collection. That was always done by men. Counting the collection, that was always done by men. And in that doing, and that sort of sense that there was a space for you to be with other people, that actually provided exactly the kind of emotional support that the men's shed is now seeking to replicate. So we're trying to do something that the church used to do and doing it less well. I don't know whether you've come across the journalist Simon Jenkins in The Guardian, but he is a kind of post-Christian. He's an atheist. His father was a Congregationalist minister, which is kind of the logical consequence of all that. But he is a great advocate of turning unused churches into mental health resort centres where you can deal with mental health issues in this perfectly pleasant, dry, congenial sort of environment. And at one point, he said to everybody else, "Well, of course, this was what the thing was for originally." So, as a place for people to encounter each other, to establish a sense of community, to do away with isolation, to engage in a common activity, whereby we're all directed towards the business of worship, the churches did actually function as places where your mental health was supported. Patricia Casey, you may have come across her, because she writes in a number of Irish papers. I think it may be the Sunday Independent. But she's a distinguished professor of psychiatry. I always mix up psychiatry and psychology, and she always gets really angry. But she's a very distinguished professor of one of the two, and that she has done a lot of work in how mental health is improved by virtue of the business of active religion. So if you go to mass, you go to or other place of worship, you go to church, it is good for your mental health. You are less likely, I mean, it doesn't mean to say you're preserved from mental health problems. I mean, the Archbishop of Canterbury's daughter did have terrible problems with depression, and a former Archbishop of Canterbury, E.H. Benson, he had terrible problems with depression as well. So one isn't suggesting that going to mass is a way not ever to be depressed, because that would be false, but it does have discernible outcomes in terms of better mental health. And her work is particularly interesting because it separates out the benefits attributable to hanging out with other people from the benefits attributable to being in a worshipping community. That is to say that if you're in a knitting circle or a rugby club, you do get benefits from being with other people, as we always do, because we're social animals. But the benefits that you get from going to church are actually higher by dint of it being a religious activity. So we're not only relating to each other, we're obviously relating to God as well. So there's a vertical relationship that makes sense of our horizontal relationships. At least that would be my understanding, and I may be wrong. But what we're trying to do now in bringing mental health front and centre of our endeavours is actually trying again to reproduce what the church already provided. That is to say, a space where we were there as brothers and sisters. I mean, the one place where I meet routinely people of other ethnicities and talk to them and get on with them, and where somebody calls me sister, is in mass, because the parish that I belong to in London does have a number of people from other races, if you like. Black people and those many other ethnicities, and that's where we're there together in genuine solidarity, genuine siblinghood, not sort of the fake or imposed kind. So again, let's get back to the simple point. The practice of religion did provide something that we're now trying to replicate, and we're replicating it less well. When it comes also to social inequality, I've been asked to review something called The Two-Parent Privilege. It's a book about, I think it's somebody from the University of Kansas, so it's going to be written in impenetrable English, but the gist of it is that, is it? Oh, well done. I said that I was going to review it. I didn't say I was going to read it. The thing is that it says that having two parents, I assume of opposite genders, or separate genders, or whatever you want to call it, it actually gives you a socio-economic advantage. That is to say that if you've got a mother and a father, ideally your biological mother and father, then and you grow up with them in that context, then it gives you a socially, social and psychological and financial and economic advantage over your peers. Now, when we were, when I my generation was growing up, we didn't realize we had a two-parent privilege. It's just that everybody had it, so we took that degree of psychic security for granted. Of course, it was a means whereby abusive relationships happened, and many marriages were unhappy, and many women were treated very badly. Nonetheless, on the whole, all things considered, for children, there was, as I say, this degree of psychic security, which did actually add to one's sense of well-being and a sense of having a solid place in the world, which is, I gather, less the case if you belong to a single parent and where you have a number of other adults coming into your life and passing out of it. So that business of the two-parent privilege was something that actually was provided by the church through the institution known as marriage. And it's something that we're trying to replicate again. So David wants me to wind up, but what I would say is we want to try and re-identify ourselves as Catholics, not in terms of issues, but in terms of what we do. So Catholicism is about doing things. It's about worship. It's about activity. The John Lavery exhibition at the National Gallery has just opened, and a really good exhibition, and I'd recommend it. But there's one really lovely picture called St. Patrick's Purgatory, which I think is Lough Derg. So we've got there a painting which is full of activity. There's people at the Holy Well kneeling down. There's people at a crucifix kneeling down. There's somebody else hearing confession. And then there's about six different places where you have activity, Catholics doing things in connection with the practice of the faith. It's a pilgrimage, and there's penitence, there's austerity, there's prayer, and this is what constituted the faith. It's not something in your head. It's not your particular posture in respect to particular social issues. The faith is about practical activity, not simply something that's which is an attitude of mind. And as I say, we're worshiping animals, and this is something that, for instance, the Greek Orthodox Church has managed to preserve icons in every home, for instance, in the way that the Sacred Heart used to be ubiquitous in every Catholic household, and we have somehow managed to lose that. I would want to emphasize, however, what Professor Casey said, which is about not trying to be hostile to the other. That is to say, try and be friendly to people who are obviously wrong. So I've got a colleague who is the quintessence of woke. He is the walking embodiment of woke. We disagree on every single subject, and he despises me. And I don't exactly despise him, but he's just wrong, simple as that. But in fact, we've got a reasonably good relationship. And the more we disagree, in a funny way, the more he kind of winds me up, and the more I annoy him. So what one must remember is that we do have this old-fashioned notion of loving the enemy. And so, as Professor Casey said, we must all the time try to engage. And if somebody likes you as a person and sees you as a person and enjoys your company and likes to hang out with you and thinks you're a great person to have a beer with, it is more easy to discuss the contentious issues with that person in the context of the beer or the cup of coffee or whatever, or the hanging out at the bus stop, because you already have a relationship in which those conversations can happen. And the trouble nowadays is that conversations don't happen. Now, Terry Eagleton, who I'd recommend, as you probably know, his book on culture, but he's written very widely about the church. He did a terrific book called Hope Without Optimism, which I think more or less sums up where we are. That is to say, it's a difficult situation, but without trying to be unrealistic about it, you must try and be hopeful about it. And but my Hebrew is nil, but as I understand it, in the Septuagint, the concept of hope in Greek means sort of neutral about the outcome. It's we're hoping for the best, but could be the worst. But in Hebrew, as I gather it, it's got other meanings as well. And it's hope, of course, in our sense, of course, but it's also to trust and to endure. And I think that's what we've got to try and hold in tension. Hope without optimism, but trust and endurance. And I think those are the things that we will need in the struggles ahead. And good luck with it.